For BBS Radio, this is Health Frontiers with Lexi Ross. Well, the Da Vinci Code is really at the top of people's minds, and there is so much controversy about the theories and the discoveries and the so-called secret stories that have been distributed around Rennes-le-Château. And tonight we have a Robin Quayle, who has been to Rennes-le-Château 18 times and actually helped some of the people who were gathering for looking for treasure there. Good evening, Robin.
Hello.
It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
I'm really curious to hear the Rennes-le-Château story, and I'm wondering what drew you there in the first place. How did you ever start going? And being, you probably hold the record for visits to Rennes-le-Château.
Well, about 16, 17 years ago, I read the first book I knew about that area was called The Holy Blood, Holy Grail by Henry Lincoln and two other authors, and he's the one that did the big BBC special on that area and all that. And all that had been going on for quite a while, of course, before the Da Vinci Code came out. Well, that fascinated me, and I knew of one or two people that had been. And then a friend of mine went over there and called and said, "Oh, my God, you've got to come." And so I wound up going, and in fact, took a few friends along, and was just hooked from that from that visit on. So I've been going every year. I at least get over there a couple of times and take groups over there, and also developed a lot of friends. And it's a magical area, and I'm in love with it.
Well, there are actually, I mean, besides all the treasures that were supposedly found there, there are actually sacred geometry configurations in the earth there, are they not?
Well, right, yeah. Why don't we back up a little bit and then tell you how the information came out to begin
with.
Okay. Around the turn of the century, there was a priest that was sent to Rennes-le-Château. Now, Rennes-le-Château is a tiny, of course, you've been there, Lexi, tiny village on top of a 1,700-foot mountain, a small mountain, and it's just, it has, you know, you can see all the way around from the top of the mountain, all the villages around, and, but it's so tiny that it's not even on most maps in France, and lots of people all over France had never even heard of it, and, so this priest was sent there, and at that time it was just, the place was crumbling. There were about 30 houses, the church was crumbling apart, the presbytery wasn't even fit to live in where he had to stay, and there were no roads down the mountain, there was no running water. It was in derelict condition. So somehow some parishioner gave him some money to start remodeling the church. And
Was this the church that was, I mean, who had built the church?
The church was built in, I think it was about the 8th century. It's dedicated to Mary Magdalene. And he started remodeling it. And in remodeling it, he found some documents in the, in some pillows there. And he also found two skeletons beneath the altar, and he found a bag of gold coins. So the documents were in code, and so I think they were in Latin, and they were in code. And so anyway, when that became apparent, he had showed them to several of his friends who were priests who were knowledgeable about such matters, and they recommended that he go to Paris, to the Church of Saint Sulpice, which figured prominently in the Da Vinci Code book, if you recall. There was a murder there, and it's a very metaphysical, mystical church, and there's an obelisk right in the church, a tall obelisk, which is where the Paris Meridian begins, and the Paris Meridian goes almost right through Rennes-le-Château.
Is that right?
And so actually at one time we were supposed to maybe have Paris Mean Time instead of Greenwich Mean Time. There was a controversy about that for a long time. They finally just settled on Greenwich. So anyway, that figures somehow into the geometry too. But anyway, this priest took these documents there, and some of the Jesuit priests who were the intellectuals of the Catholic order helped decode them. And also he showed them to a woman, Maria Calvé, who was a very famous opera singer at that time, and she was an occultist, and she was very much prominent in all those occult salons that were, you know, were going on in Paris. And so all these, somehow, it never said exactly whether he was told exactly or not, but there was a little vagueness about it. But anyway, what evidently these documents showed was a tremendous secret that had been carefully guarded through the centuries. And it evidently was that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, and that Mary Magdalene did come to France. I think that's historically known. And that she was that they had children. She was supposedly pregnant when she came, but also had another child, a daughter. So, and she became a very respected and loved disciple of Jesus in Provence and Languedoc. The legends of her are legendary, and so many places are dedicated to her, churches and chapels and sites all throughout those regions.
Does anybody know what period of time she spent there?
She stayed there the rest of her life, according to the legends. And
but I mean, was that like 30 or 40 years? Or?
Oh, no, it was right after the crucifixion, as I understand, because those people were they were in danger. And so this is what the legends say, that Joseph of Arimathea was Jesus' uncle, and he provided the tomb that Jesus was buried in. And he was also a wealthy tin trader, and he had a ship. And so he took 500 followers, Christians or people that would have been possibly killed in the Holy Land because of the political danger. So they came to the south of France to a little village on the Mediterranean called Saint-Marie de la Mer, which is the Saint Mary's of the Sea. And so supposedly there was Mary Magdalene, her brother Lazarus, her daughter, Mary Jacobi, Mary Salome, which figure in they're relatives of these people. I can't remember exactly now. And then supposedly the Mother Mary was on the ship. And then about 500 people in all. And came up the Rhone River to this little tiny village and landed there. And so every year on May the 25th is a festival, a two-day festival, where about 10,000 people come to celebrate that landing and reenact it.
Now, is this in Rennes-le-Château that they celebrate, or the place where they first landed?
No, on the Mediterranean in the little village, Saint-Marie de la Mer.
I see.
And so I've been to that festival many times, and it's really exciting. And the many, many, many gypsies that come, because Sarah was on the ship, and they consider her their saint. Now, some people think that she was the daughter of Mary Magdalene and Jesus. I don't know, but she was called the Dark One. And so there's a statue of her in the crypt in the basement part of the church. And
why did they call her the Dark One?
The Dark One, because her skin was dark and her stature's dark. And maybe she had gypsy blood, I don't know. But or
Egyptian.
Is it
possible she could have been black?
Or Egyptian or something.
Uh-huh.
And so the statue of her is, you know, it's like gypsy-colored, brownish. And it's down there, and they have many healings. They have so many healings that there are piles and piles and piles in the back of that of you know, crutches and things, braces and wheelchairs, and ever so often they make a donation to a hospital. And then the walls are absolutely covered from floor to ceiling with testimonies from them and paintings and blessings that where they've received these healings. And then upstairs there are also many testimonies. And that upstairs is a boat on the wall with statues in it, maybe 8 feet long, 6 or 8 feet long. And they take that down into the water. The horses take it down. And then on the first day, the gypsies take Sarah's statue into the water. And then the second day, they take the boat. And they have parades, and the gypsies are all in their finery and their gypsy wagons and their horses and their, you know, their gypsy finery and clothes and everything. It's kind of an... But not everyone who comes are gypsies, and many others. But the gypsies seem to be especially devout about it. And
I'm curious if that's the village that where all the celebration takes place, then why is it that Run Le Chateau became the source for all the mysteries?
Well, I don't think Mary Magdalene stayed there. Mary Jacobi and Mary Salome stayed there, but evidently the others sort of spread around. And Mary Magdalene supposed to have traveled and taught as a disciple. All in South and Southwest France. And Rennes Le Chateau, many people think that she lived just below there. There's a place called the Val d'Or, which is a farm. And it's like it's less than a half a mile from, it's still on the mountain, but it's less than a half a mile from Rennes Le Chateau. And, there's a farm, and the Val d'Or means the Valley of God. And a lady I know owns it and runs it as a kind of a rustic bed and breakfast, an organic farm, and there are Celtic ruins of all kind of chapel and roads and things on the property. And so she says that it was known... it was been called that for 2,000 years because of the association to the Holy Family. Mm-hmm. And some people think that Jesus later arrived and joined her, because another mystery of the book is that possibly Jesus survived the crucifixion and or was resurrected but stayed in his body and went to India for a period of time and then possibly came back to...
Isn't that the theory of the book, The Disappearance of the Universe?
Of the who?
Don't they talk of the disappearance of the universe? Don't they make that proposition that Jesus survived and that that he did come, in fact, to France?
I don't know about the part about France. I'm not... I don't want to address that because I'm not totally clear. I just finished reading the book, which absolutely blew me away, but I'd have to double-check that issue. He did mention every now and then things like that, but he did say that... I do remember that he said that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, but I can't remember whether or not he said... I don't know if they talked about France.
Okay.
The book was not a book of prophecy, really. It was only every now and then that the little thing would drop out like that.
I see. So then how, my understanding is that when the monk, what was his name again?
Saunier, the
when
priest.
When Saunier found the treasure or whatever it is he found, that then there was a great deal of money, and that he had spent it in the community, and then he took the documents to the Vatican. Is that right?
Well, no, he took the documents to Paris.
Okay.
And you know, I told you, I did, and asked for help from these Jesuits and from this famous occultists and all, and just started studying the research that was available about it. Well, we don't know that he found a treasure other than the small bag of gold coins, because after this, he became, almost overnight, he became a multi-millionaire, and nobody knows whether he found a treasure or whether we do know that he would go to some tunnels and caverns that were beneath Rennes Le Chateau, and he took lots of long walks and things that were very mysterious at night. But it's not known. I think that the researchers more consider that he was paid possibly by the Habsburg family, which are, you see, there's a bloodline, and they call the bloodline is what they say is the real Holy Grail. You know, for all these centuries, we've had all this tremendous mystery and mythology and everything grown up about the Holy Grail. You know, we've got the King Arthur thing, and we've got the troubadours singing about it, and we've got books and mysteries and everything. I mean, so nobody knows for sure. I mean, some people say, well, it's the cup that, you know, they caught the blood of Jesus when he was, Pilate was pierced, or that maybe it was the cup he used at the Last Supper, or things like that. But they tend to think that's more a symbol for actually the bloodline, and that the bloodline is the real important part, and that this is the secret that has been treasured and protected all these years, because it would have been heresy in the church to put out information like this. And so there are many encoded clues to this, like, for instance, the famous painter Nicolas Poussin has paintings in the Louvre that purport to show some of the mysteries. And he was a member of the famous Prior de Sion, which was a secret society, which was addressed in the Da Vinci Code quite a bit, and which evidently has existed for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, supposedly for the express purpose of protecting this secret. Now, they're protecting the bloodline, and
what did the paintings show?
Well, one of the paintings, the most famous one, is called The Shepherds of Arcadia, and it depicts a tomb that used, just some few years back, used to reside on a hilltop only a few miles from Rennes Le Chateau, not on the mountain, but the painting shows this tomb, and in the background you can clearly see the delineation of the mountain, the outline of the village of Rennes Le Chateau. And then around the tomb are several shepherds and a woman who seems to be pregnant and who is said to be Mary Magdalene. And the shepherds are pointing to an inscription on the tomb, and let me see if I can remember the inscription. I believe it says, "Et in Arcadia, or the treasure is in Arcadia, and this treasure belongs to Dagobert, and he is there dead." I believe that may be the inscription. Something like that. Or I may be wrong. The inscription may be on something else that's important. But it refers to Arcadia, too, which Arcadia has a mysterious significance throughout all of this story, all the way down to the Acadians, you know, left France and came to Nova Scotia and were driven down to Louisiana. You remember all that?
No, I don't. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, I've been very interested in trying to trace the whole meaning of Arcadia, because it goes back to very ancient times and what it exactly means. But I don't have all the answers to that yet, but it's something I'm working on. Anyway... The priest took this money, and he built, he redid the church very beautifully, and he decorated it in some very strange and mysterious ways that people don't totally understand to this day. And he built a very beautiful villa and a beautiful tower dedicated to Mary Magdalene, and terraces and gardens and fountains and all kind of things. Now, he did not build the villa for him to stay in himself. He built it. He said it was to eventually be a retirement home for elderly priests. But his wealthy friends like the Habsburgs and Maria Calvé and people like that were coming to Rennes-le-Château, and he would house them there when they came, and he gave these wonderful dinner parties. And his housekeeper, who evidently was his mistress, they say, whom he left everything to, although some people say he also had an affair with Maria Calvé, you know, there are many speculations. But he was a very well-loved person. He gave all the people in the village very, very much money, which would be huge sums today.
And this is the money, I want to clarify, that they don't know whether the money came from the treasury or whether the money came when he took these documents to Paris, right? That he might have been paid.
No. Somebody, evidently, this is what they think, made him payments, possibly to keep him quiet about all that he had discovered. Either the some people have said the Vatican, but I don't believe it was the Vatican, because the Vatican demanded over and over to know where he got the money, and he would never tell. And so finally he was defrocked, so to speak, and he just kept giving masses in the Villa Batania. And the new priest had to walk all the way up that mountain, and had that, because the presbytery was still uninhabitable.
What do you mean? What do you mean by the new priest? I don't know.
Well, when they defrocked him, they assigned a new priest.
I see.
The new priest was coming up there, and he had to come right by the Villa Batania to get to the church, and there he was with all the whole village in his mass, and the new priest would go in the church and give mass, and nobody was there.
Oh, for heaven's sake!
But he was adored actually by the villagers, because he was very wonderful to all of them. He gave them huge sums, and he fixed roads, and he made running water, and he built this beautiful. He made Rennes-le-Château, you know, a very famous place. It's very beautiful. Planted all kind of rare trees, and so then he died mysteriously. On a mysterious day, too, January the 17th, it figures in many other dates that occur in that book. I can't give you all the references right this moment, but January the 17th turned out to be a very significant day, and he supposedly died of a stroke. And another priest near there, some time before that, was found stabbed to death. So I don't know if that had anything to do with this mystery or not, but the church definitely did not want this stuff known.
So talk about the bloodline. I mean, that seems to be the...
Okay, well, you know, I've met many people over there who are very Catholic. And they are staunch Catholics. And on one side, on their left brain, they go to church and they perform all the rituals and everything, and they believe totally in everything the church teaches. But on the right side of their brain, I'm configuring it this way, they will tell you all about Jesus and Mary Magdalene's children and where they lived and, you know, things like that.
Did any of them reveal any kind of names or anything?
I think one of the boys was named James. My friend, the archaeologist, Graham Simmons, who lived at Rennes-le-Château for so many years, and whom I worked with for about 8 years, he was tunneling, and we did things like dowsing and remote viewing and regressions and psychic work and all kinds of things to show him where to tunnel. And so
and he had that tunnel. in his backyard, covered over with a private sort of he had constructed something to so that people wouldn't see the tunnel.
Right. He lived over where part of it was tunneling, but since it was illegal to tunnel there, he had built a shed in the backyard, which had a wall around it too, and that's where the tunnel began.
Well, what led him to believe that particular location? I mean, what was he looking for?
Well, he always said that many people have been looking for treasure there for many years.
And why did they feel like there was more treasure? That's what I've never understood.
Well, these are the legends, and some of the legends even think that the Templars' treasures, which were vast, or that treasures that we even brought from Solomon's temple, where the Templars started their work, may be down there. There's one book that details that there's a huge treasure down there, and that there's a tunnel that goes all the way under that mountain, all the way to Peshkadu, which by car is about 15 minutes away, and which these men that wrote The Tomb of God wrote a book about. They believe that the Jesus' tomb is in this mountain, and they believe that they have historical information to prove it, and they petitioned the French government for permission to go in there and search for this tomb. Well, let me tell you another little tomb story that I discovered several years ago. They had a new mayor who came to Rennes-le-Château from Spain, and one of his first acts on being installed was to get a bulldozer and go down in the woods about maybe a quarter of a mile from Rennes-le-Château or something. There's a stream called Les Labadoux, which means place of washing, and there were many swimming holes and places that we used to swim in and things, and it was a water source for Rennes-le-Château. So he took this bulldozer and went so far down in the woods that when we later went down there, it took about an hour or more of really strenuous climbing to get to it, because it was, you know, there were rocks and fences and walls and hills and all kind of things. It was not easy to even climb to. So I couldn't even imagine how they got a bulldozer down there. But anyway, he went up and got a bulldozer. He tore up the water source. He did tremendous environmental damage and so forth. But he got a slab of stone. It was evidently an ancient Templar stone that was in a small pool that this stream went into. And so it was covered partially with sand, and I don't know how many people had known that it was there. But he dug it out and took it out of the country, possibly to Spain, they think, where he was from. And possibly, the stories say, he took it to the Basque country, where there's a great, supposedly, Templar stronghold today. Now, we don't know if those Templars that exist today have a direct line of the ancient Templar. The Templars were, you know, they were their whole study in themselves. I was reading another book last night about them. They are the ones who started the banking systems in Europe. They had vast wealth. So anyway, well, this man was fined, he was fired, he was indicted, all kinds of problems about having gone in there and torn up that water source and stolen this stone. And so I have some friends who live at Rennes-le-Château who are actually Dutch, and they belong to a Templar order, and which now admits women. And so they take this order very seriously. And they told me that they were told by the people in their order, the Templars, that this stone marked where Jesus was buried.
Really?
And that's just the other stories. Now, Graham thought that possibly he was going to find some very important tombs he never would say Jesus, but I think that perhaps he was hoping for something like that. He thought maybe Mary Magdalene, maybe Joseph of Arimathea, famous Templars, a repository of all kinds of information that maybe someday somebody will still find it. But he died while I was there. You were with me last August.
Right.
He died the day we left, I think. He got sick the day we arrived and died the day we left.
Yeah, I was sorry I didn't get a chance to
talk. I know, because he was a fascinating man. He had uncovered the whole Coptic Christian villages in Egypt.
So can you explain further, a little bit with more detail, the connection between the Cathars and the Templars and Jesus, and why that whole mystery comes together?
Okay, now the Cathars... area of importance rose in, I think, in the 11th century. And they were a huge civilization there, really, in France, all in southern, southwest France. They had so much land and so much assets that they were actually wealthier than the king of France. And so they were Christians, but they would not join the Catholic Church. And they were called the Pure Ones. And so...
Why were they called the Pure Ones?
Well, because they... And also the Bonhommes, which meant good man.
Good men,
because they were so good. And they didn't even have sex except for... when,
procreation?
Yeah, for procreation.
Yeah.
And...
were they vegetarians?
I'm not sure about that. So I think some of them were and some weren't. There's a wonderful book called The Cathars and Reincarnation. It really goes into a lot of detail about the Cathars, and they mention that. But anyway, the Cathars and also the troubadours were somehow, seemed to be very connected to the Cathars. The Cathars followed the simple teachings of Jesus. And the troubadours were very much about Mary Magdalene, although it was sort of in a code form. They sang the song of her everywhere, but people thought they were singing about romantic love. And they were really talking about Our Lady. And so everywhere in Europe, everywhere else in Europe, you know, the Virgin Mother is venerated at all the cathedrals and everything, you know. But in this part of France, you will see so much adulation and love of Mary Magdalene. And when you see that, there's no thing in the church that... you know, in the early teachings, I mean, before the Catholic thing really got going, that, you know, your priest couldn't be married.
Right.
And Jesus was called Rabbi 80-something times in the Bible. Well, in those days in Jewish law, a rabbi had to be married. And every Jewish man, as I understand it, young men were supposed to be married. And then there's some references like the wedding of Cana is mentioned in Holy Blood, Holy Grail as possibly the wedding of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, because the mother...
Do you have any idea how old they would have been at this point?
Were they
in their 40s? How old would they have been at that point? Were they in their 40s when they're there? I mean, Jesus was crucified, what, supposedly in his 30s?
Oh, yeah. So
and
that
Mary
was
Magdalene...
earlier.
Yeah, Mary Magdalene, does anybody know whether she was
ten years
younger than him, or was she equal to his age? Or
I don't know exactly, but I think she was a young, very young woman.
Uh-huh.
But the mother, I mean, the mother Mary comes and says, "Son, we're out of wine. What are you going to do about it? Who is most concerned when you run out of wine at a wedding?"
Now,
who
you're
cares?
Talking about the wedding of Cana right now, right?
Hmm?
You're
the
talking about the wedding of Cana.
Okay, wouldn't it be one of the hostesses, the mother of the bride or the mother of the groom, who would really be upset if you ran out of wine?
Exactly.
And then the reference is that the anointing of Jesus was a sign of only a wife could have done that. And then to anoint the body, only a wife in Jewish law was allowed to do that. And, of course, then she's the first one that Jesus appeared to. And the thing about the prostitute, that came up. Some pope in the 13th century decided that the prostitute that was mentioned in the Bible was Mary Magdalene.
I see.
And I think, again, that was possibly just a device of the church to put down her status as the wife of Jesus.
Yeah, to diminish her importance.
Mm-hmm. And also, you have to understand that in all of Europe, for so many centuries, the patriarchal church ruled, you know, and women were put down to a very lowly status. They were not allowed to be priests or cardinals or anything in the church except nuns, and they had to be celibate, and, you know, they were cloistered and so on and so on. But in this part of France, where the Cathars lived, the feminine, the divine feminine, was flourishing. The only place in Europe.
Is that right?
Where this, yeah, where women were looked upon. Women could be, you know, heads in the Cathar movement. They could have these higher positions, prefects and so forth. But
is that still true today?
Well, they killed all the Cathars.
I mean, do women still hold a place in, say, in the Catholic churches in that area?
No, I didn't say Catholic. I said Cathar.
No, I know you said Cathar, but I mean, is that tradition sort of followed in other religions that came after them?
Well, no, because the Pope sent the Albigensian Crusaders to murder all the Cathars, and they squashed that whole movement of the emergence of the divine feminine.
I see.
What is happening today, I think, is that there's a reemergence of that awareness of the feminine nature that must be found in every man and every woman and in, you know, every soul, that we all have that. And so I think it's starting to flower. But it is all over the world, just like in that movie, The Whale Rider. Did you see that movie?
Yeah, I remember that.
Where women had been suppressed in their culture, and then finally there was a breakthrough because of a little girl's courage and destiny and all to challenge that. And then when she succeeded, everybody changed.
Well, what are all the implications? I mean, now we have established that Jesus may have, you know, been married to Mary Magdalene, that he did have some children. But
there's a bloodline today.
Yeah, that's what I was asking you. I asked you for the names, but does anybody know the last names? I mean, you gave me...
Yes, it's Pierre Sinclair, which used to be called Sinclair.
Uh-huh.
And it's been changed now to Sinclair.
I see.
Plantard.
How do you spell that?
Plantard, and he has a son who is now in his 20s, I guess.
And
Plantard used to be the Grand Master of the Prior de Sion, but I don't think he is right now. But people like Da Vinci and Victor Hugo and all the greats throughout all the historical years in Europe, all the great names have been either members or grandmasters of the Prior de Sion.
Well, explain about that organization, Tara.
Well, that's what I was telling you. It was a secret organization that Henry Lincoln said was sole purpose was to protect the bloodline.
I see.
But it's a secret organization. And you remember in the Da Vinci Code, they talked about it quite a bit. But once when I was in Paris, I went with a friend to visit a woman named Madame de Cherissy, who is also one of that bloodline families. And we had breakfast in her apartment, or her, she owned an apartment building there that was very lovely and very old. And her brother had been a member of the Priory de Sion and had a very close association with Plantard. Well, her brother had just died, and she was telling us that there was, you know, many files and boxes of papers relating to the Priory de Sion that had been handed over to their son, her brother's son. So we made contact with the brother's son and tried to see if there was some way. He didn't have any interest in this at all, he said. If we could, you know, obtain these or see them or copy them or something, but it was to no avail. But it's interesting because I just saw another article just the other day about the Cherissy family and this man's association with Plantard. Now, can I just tell you one story about something that happened near Rennes-le-Château there?
Oh, sure.
That I think points to the significance of the place. There's a tremendous vortex there, and I've been told it's one of the three places on the planet where a person can be transformed, that the earth-sky energies are so concurrent. But anyway, there's a little hotel that's very charming and sweet, has horses and swimming pool and all, and it's right, oh, it's like a less than a quarter of a mile from Rennes-le-Château. It's on the mountain, too. And those people own about 200 acres, and a lot of it is very flat because I've ridden the horses all over that area. And so for some reason, I don't know why they did this, but this French National Bibliothèque made some aerial photographs in that area with infrared photography. Now, I never have gotten an explanation of why they did that, and I haven't seen much written about this. But one day I was getting on the plane in Paris to come home, and the stewardess hands me a newspaper article, a newspaper that has a half page, a page and a half, and half of the front page is about this occurrence. Well, Rennes-le-Château isn't even, it's so obscure until the Da Vinci Code came out. Nobody even knew who it was. So, anyway,
How many years ago did that take place?
What?
How many years ago did they do that?
It was about 5 years ago.
I see.
So, anyway, the article said that this, it had a picture of it in the paper. This huge, huge, huge image. It is the dimensions, but I remember several hundreds of feet, a dimension of delineation of a Madonna-looking figure with two babies, and there's also another figure in there that's sort of a dog or jackal-looking figure, kind of Egyptian-like.
And this is in the earth.
It's in the subsoil. And it could not have been recovered until we had aerial photography and we had infrared photography. They have no idea how it was put there, but they know it's ancient. They don't know how it was put there, why it was put there, or when exactly it was put there. But evidently it seems to point another one of the clues, just like that Templar stone. By the way, that Templar stone had a Templar cross on it. To the fact that this is a very sacred and special place. And then at the Val d'Or, they found, you know, an ancient spring that had a rockwork around it that's been restored, and an ancient statue of supposedly Mary Magdalene near it. And it was the legend said that people came from many villages there to get their water. Now, think about it. They had to walk up a 1,700-foot mountain to get that water when they were, and all those villages all around have beautiful springs, famous water, famous Roman springs abound in that area. But they said they came to get that water because of the Holy Family.
Interesting.
And so this, so I just love to collect the legends. Now, whether they're all true, there's so many mysteries.
What conclusions do you draw from? I mean, after all the research, after your friend who had the, you know, was digging for the treasure and all the times.
Well, he wasn't really, said he wasn't digging for treasure, and I really don't believe because he was a true archaeologist.
Uh-huh. But what conclusions do you draw about the Rennes-le-Château mystery, and what implications do you think it has?
Well, I think that Mary Magdalene lived either there or right there at the Val d'Or or somewhere near there for a long time. There are other places that she's said to have lived, you know, a famous cave down in Provence, Saint-Baume. But I think that she spread her influence and that she was very, very loved and very... This bloodline was supposed to be the first Merovingian kings of France. And then...
First what? I'm sorry, I didn't know.
The Merovingian line. I think Marie Antoinette, I believe, was of that bloodline.
Oh, is that right?
Uh-huh. And, you know, of the Savoy family, supposed to be of that bloodline, and the De Guise family, and, many people that I've actually known were mentioned in that book. I mean, their families were mentioned in that book that were part of that holy blood, holy grail bloodline.
So you believe that everything that they suggest in the Da Vinci Code is true?
The Da Vinci Code was a novel just using this historical background.
Right.
And, of course, there was that huge lawsuit that the Holy Blood, Holy Grail office instituted against Dan Brown, which they failed. And I didn't understand the reason for the lawsuit anyway, since the historical information was known in other sources besides Holy Blood, Holy Grail. It wasn't, you know, they had to get the information from somewhere to write their book. And authors do that all the time. I mean, you're an author, you know that.
Yeah. So the conclusions that you come to are what? I mean, and do you think that this is really going to deter people from believing the Bible and believing?
Oh, it doesn't make me not believe the Bible. You know, I just think that the Bible has been changed so much by the church that they're so afraid that people will, the church is very afraid of that, and they're very afraid of that thing about the shroud being declared real.
Uh-huh.
That those things would, because the shroud, the latest research on the shroud shows that it was a person that was of Jesus' time and his region, and he was crucified, he had the crown of thorns, the nails, the wound in the side, and all those things. It doesn't prove it was Jesus, but it proves that it was possible. And that it was of a man who was alive when he was wrapped in the shroud. And then there's another cloth that has come to light, which evidently historically was well known. I can't remember, it has a name. But it was a face cloth, and it's in Spain. And they've had very careful records about where that cloth had been kept. Well, that's been proved to be the same DNA.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. So I've had a lot of interest in researching the shroud. You know, this man here in Atlanta just died who was a famous researcher whom I didn't know about.
Who was that?
I don't have his name right now, but, the Savoy family owned that shroud until 1983.
So how many families total are there that are supposedly of the lineage?
Oh, I don't know exactly, but quite a few are mentioned in the book. The Fleury family?
Yeah.
Does that ring a bell?
Fleury, yeah. Absolutely.
You see, just in our little circle, there are people whose families have been mentioned, and that man that had the gold thing out in Arizona, you remember him?
No, I don't know who you're talking to about.
You know, the man that discovered that white powder gold. David Hudson.
No, I'm not familiar with him.
Oh, okay, sorry. Well, he got to be very well known, and he found out that his bloodline, I believe his was a De Guise line.
I see. So there's at least 5 or 6 families.
Oh, many more.
Is that right?
Oh, many more than that, yeah. Well, families, you know, have a way of mushrooming and spreading out. But, I don't know how many, but there are many more than that mentioned in the book.
Well, we certainly all will be looking forward to seeing the Da Vinci Code. And
next week, I think, right.
I think it was coming out this week, actually.
Oh, really?
And it's been very interesting to have some of your insights about actually being there and seeing the things that transpired and meeting some of the, archaeologists were actually doing the digs there. And people do continue to come in and seek for archaeological finds.
Well, the Nazis did a lot of searching there. You know, they thought that there was some legendary gold, like maybe the gold from King Solomon's mines and things were there. In fact, I've been told by Jim Mars that the Nazis took trainloads of gold out of that area.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? We're running out of time, Robin, but I want to thank you for your sharing your experiences with Renless Chateau. And,
well, I always love to talk about it.
And I'm sure all of us will be very excited to see the movie and see how they've interpreted all of it. And since we are running out of time, I am going to have to say goodnight.
Good night.
Thank you. And for BBS Radio, this has been Lexi Ross with Elf Frontiers.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.